Of old, when men lay sick and sorely tried, the doctors gave them physic, and they died. But here's a happier age, for now we know both how to make men sick and keep them so. I first became emotionally involved in the whole problem of the rights to die when I was stationed as a naval chaplain in the Far East. I was quartered in Yokosuka, the United States Naval Base in Japan, which included a 2,000-bed major medical and surgical hospital. We were only 2 hours or so by air from the battlefields in Korea. And after the Marine casualties had been given emergency and first aid treatment at forward stations, they were airlifted to our base. One whole section of a neurosurgical ward was given over to the bodies of young men whose forebrain had been blown away by shell fire, fragmentation. The skills of modern surgery made it possible to stop the bleeding, to cauterize the wounds, to close the wound. But the doctors are not gods. And the control centers of the body had been shattered, blown apart. And these young men were, in effect, vegetables in living form, in human form. Their hearts were young. The instinct to breathe was strong. It was possible to feed them intravenously. They were placed on motorized cots, which allowed the fluids of the body to move about a bit. And these vegetables refused to die, or at least to die by our then current definition of the term. They lived long enough, most of them, to be transported back to the United States to a Veterans Administration hospital near their wives, near their families, and their homes. And there they lived, the doctors told me, from a year to a year and a half before the heart would give out or breathing would stop and death would intervene. Now, these vegetables suffered no pain. But think of the pain that was caused to a wife, a child, a father, or mother. Not only the cruelty of losing a son in war, but the cruelty of being in limbo, having to visit this living corpse, having one's whole emotional family life stop for a year and a half, unable to pick up the pieces of one's life and to carry on, all because medical science was such that the death had not happened when the death should have happened. We live in a strange and glorious time. But some of our more miraculous and hopeful accomplishments bring in their train great pain. And when I would argue with the doctors, why not pull the plug? Why not just avoid feeding this vegetable intravenously. They answered me in largest part because of Navy regulations. Our careers would be ruined if this was ever discovered. And in part because of their self-definition as physicians, we are here to heal and not to kill. One of them quoted to me the Hippocratic Oath. And I went back and I researched the oath. And I discovered that it says in one section that a physician is not to administer a poisonous drug, or to give people counsel as to the use of these drugs. But it didn't seem to me to say anything specifically that was relevant to the case at hand. But I lost each and every one of these arguments. And I really expected to, because the fault was not the doctors. They were the heirs of a medical tradition which had suddenly become something quite different, whose standards had been built up during an age when the physician could really do very little, when he was suspect, and when he was often turned to by people for all the wrong reasons, the poisons. They have tried so hard to heal, to prolong life, that they fear what will happen to the profession if they must involve themselves in moral or ethical questions which are not purely medical, purely technical. And they, like us, are products of a society which has refused to look upon death in any natural way as part of the cycle of life itself. Hedonists, affluent, emotionally affluent, we have forgotten or want to forget that we are born to die. We try and push off death as if death were always and ever an enemy. We fear death. We have taken it out of our homes, and we've taken it out of our lives. We've placed it in other institutions. We've grown unaccustomed to death. And because of that, we tend to think that we must do anything and everything to keep it away from us and from those whom we love. We've forgotten that for many, death would be a friend, a welcome visitor, far from an enemy. But be that as it may, the simple fact is, in the last quarter of a century, medical technology and medical science have changed our capacities to deal with death in a qualitative and quantitative way. And we still describe death in rather primitive and mechanistic terms. We can now put a body in a respirator, which will simulate and force breathing even when the automatic mechanisms of the body give out. We can put a patient on a dialysis machine when his kidneys no longer function. We can put electrical shock to the chest of a patient and start a heart which has stopped beating. And in this kind of age, for many, the definition of death remains not one which has something to do with awareness or consciousness or control, but simply pulse, breathing, the temperature of the body. Have you watched, as I have watched, the reporting on the bedside vigil for ex-President Harry Truman? The old man is 88 years of age. He's had the last of a series of heart attacks. He's obviously suffering from kidney failure. The reports which are given every 4 hours from the hospital make it seem as if medical science is waging a battle against an all-powerful enemy, one which must be defeated at any cost in order to do something called keeping President Truman alive. And I confess that I've wondered all week about what's happening in that hospital in Kansas City. For I've been in other hospital rooms with other 88-year-old patients, suffering much the breakdown of their bodies that President Truman seems to be suffering from, and I've listened to them as they've looked up at me and said, "Rabbi, why can't they leave me alone? Why can't they know that I'm not afraid of death? I've had my life. I want to die. No more pinpricks, no more taking blood. Just let me be." And I wonder if President Truman really believes that if he's pulled through this particular crisis, someone, the doctors, have really done him a favor. It's because of incidents such as this, the capacity of the medical profession to accomplish too much, that a number of groups have come together under various terms to try and discuss how one can prevent this kind of medical indignity from happening to those whom we love, particularly to ourselves. Several weeks ago, I received from one member of the congregation a form. It's obviously a form which had been prepared for physicians, clergymen, lawyers. It's called The Will to Live and the Right to Die. And this is the way the form read. It's addressed to my family, my physician, my clergyman, and my lawyer. If the time comes when I can no longer take part in decisions for my own future, let this statement stand as the testament of my wishes. If there is no reasonable expectation of my recovery from physical or mental disability, I request that I be allowed to die and not be kept alive by artificial means and heroic measures. Death is as much a reality as birth, growth, maturity, and old age. It is the one certainty. I do not fear death as much as I fear the indignity of deterioration dependent upon hopeless pain. I ask that drugs be mercifully administered to me for terminal suffering, even if they hasten the moment of death. This request is made after careful consideration. Although this document is not legally binding, you who care for me will, I hope, feel morally bound to follow this mandate. I recognize that it places a heavy burden of responsibility upon you, and it is with the intention of sharing that responsibility and of mitigating any feelings of guilt that this statement is made. And then there's a place for the signature. Now, obviously, those who sign such a statement as this have had one of the experiences or know about the kind of experience I have described. And obviously, the medical profession knows these kinds of experiences all too well. But they're bound by law, and they live under the fear of a malpractice suit. And it's not easy for them or for the society to come to grips with a problem which our new knowledge has placed before us. Now, one apparently fruitful field of change comes in the recognition that death, the word death, has no specific definition. What we mean by death is what the consensus of the society or the law of a particular society describes death to be. Why is a person who stops breathing dead and a person who's in an irreversible coma not dead? And so there have been attempts within and without the medical profession to come to a new physical definition of death, one which would take into account some of the problems, at least, which are raised by our new technology. And the most propitious area has been that which would describe death not in purely terms of purely of breathing or of heartbeat, but which describe death in terms of what's called brain death. When a person's mind is gone, when oxygen has no longer reached the mind for a sufficient period of time so that the capacities there have been erased. The youngsters would say, when the mind is blown, at that point, really, death has intervened. And there was a few years ago a group called the Ad Hoc Committee at Harvard University for a better definition of brain death. And this group defined brain death in these terms. It defines a condition of unresponsiveness and non-receptivity. It defines a condition where there are no reflex actions of any consequence in the body, and where the body's capacity to control its motions has been lost. It defines a condition where the electroencephalogram records a level reading. There are no indications of serious controlled brain action. Now, obviously, such a definition of death would save many families from a good deal of heartache. Because you and I all know the horror stories of those who are young or in middle age who go into a certain kind of irreversible coma, and who sometimes have been maintained in this kind of condition, this non-life, for 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years, even more. I have seen families in which a healthy member of the family destroyed his health or her health in order to nurse and to care for a person who was irreversibly dead. And I have seen conditions and I have seen families in which the money set aside for the college and professional education of the young has been spent maintaining a vegetable. And so it is that there seems to be some hope for this definition of brain death as an operative one in our society. But it's not an easy one for most people to accept. Check your own reactions to this story, which comes from an actual law case which was brought in the state of Virginia some 3 years ago against a group of doctors and a hospital. The charge was that they had hastened death by removing the mechanical means which supported life. The facts were these. A laborer was brought to the hospital with serious, major brain damage. He had been hit on the head by a very heavy falling object. And surgery was attempted, and the surgery could not restore consciousness, control, awareness. And the surgeon's report said that the prospect of recovery is nil. During surgery, the body had been put on various support systems, a respirator, under oxygen. It was fed intravenously. And when it was taken to the recovery room, these systems were maintained. Some 6 hours later, the body was brought back to the operating room, and now there was another patient in another bed. This patient had been prepared for a heart transplant. Now the mechanical means of life support were stopped. The respirator was turned off. The laborer's body was opened, and the heart was transplanted into the heart of another human being. Now, the family of the laborer brought the charges against the hospital. In this case, the jury returned a verdict in favor of the hospital and of the doctors They accepted the testimony of a doctor named Michael Sweet, who had been involved in this ad hoc committee to define brain death at Harvard, who told the jury, "Death is a state in which the brain is dead. The rest of the body exists in order to support the brain. The brain is the individual." The hospital, the doctors were acquitted. But what happens when I add to this story the fact that the laborer was black and the patient to whom the heart was given was white, and that the surgery took place, was done by an all-white medical team in an all-white hospital? And by raising these kinds of questions, I suggest to you not only the cultural gap all of us have when it comes to accepting brain death as a legitimate definition, but some of the social problems which intrude. If our bodies, in addition to being ours, are what this laborer's bodies became, a benevolent laboratory in which to keep various organs until there is need for them for transplant surgery, then what safeguards have we in a society if we are not of the establishment, of the powerful, close to the medical profession? That those who are eager for transplants will not use a temporary coma or some other condition in order to raid our bodies for the benefit of those whom they say have a better right to survive. This is the gray area. And it is for reasons such as this that Judaism has always refused to sanction euthanasia or mercy killing, the gentle intrusion of death by some kind of positive act. In Judaism, it is as much a crime to kill a fatally ill patient as to kill a healthy human being. The biblical proof of this, it's not really proof, but the biblical basis for this is the story which appears in the histories of the Bible. It seems that during the wars against the Philistines, a great battle took place between the Israelites under King Saul and the Philistines near Mount Gilboa. David and his troops were not somehow involved in this particular camp, in this particular battle. And after the battle, a young man appears at the camp of David, and he reports to David as follows: "As we were moving away from the battle, I chanced upon a secluded area in which I saw King Saul leaning upon his spear. He was wounded. And he called me over and he said, 'Young man, kill me. I'm in terrible agony. I am fatally ill. The breath is hardly within me. I cannot survive. Take me out of my misery.' And I obeyed the king. And David called one of his soldiers and he ordered the execution of the young man, saying, 'You have been convicted by the testimony of your own lips of having taken the life of God's anointed.'" Now, obviously, the biblical story was intended to encourage the Israelites to believe in the inviolate person of the king. Kings and presidents have always been, you know, the object of assassination. You have to build up mystiques as well as secret service around them. But no matter. The point is that the rabbis used this story as authorization, justification, for the position that no man, no physician, may take the life of one who is fatally ill. They also took the position that a physician who performed euthanasia was not liable before the court. He could not be brought in and brought on trial by a jury of his peers or before a group of rabbis. He was liable before God, but not before man. Presumably, when you make your case before God, you have a far more understanding and wise court, which will take into consideration the whole context of events. But regardless, it was a crime to take a life. And it was a crime to take a life because the Jews lived in and among those who regularly and ruthlessly took lives. Infanticide, the exposure of unwanted or deformed youngsters on the hillside, was a common and accepted fact of life among the Greeks. And Plato, the greatest of the philosophers of the Greeks, insisted that the state had the right to hasten the death of the infirm, of the invalids, of those who could not be sustained in full health. He says in the Republic, Asclepius, the great giver of all medical knowledge to man, had given to man only knowledge of how to perform instant, immediate kinds of therapy. That if he had not wanted people to be maintained and sustained in states of weakness. A great society needs only the strong, the vibrant, the vigorous, those in full control of their capacities. And the logical consequence of this is a consequence that Hitler drew from it. When he went into all the old folks' homes of Germany and denuded them of their patients and simply sent them to the camps, why must Germany pay the price for those who never be useful to their economy? And he went into all the homes for the retarded and all the nurseries for the mongoloids, and he did the same thing there. After all, a state demands function. It demands service of its citizens. And those who cannot serve are simply a load, a burden on the economy. Now, this kind of reasoning has always been in human society. There have always been those who are cold-blooded and calculating and ruthless, and who will find all kinds of rationalizations. Why sustain the aging? Of what use are they to themselves or to their families? Why sustain those who are born malformed and retarded? How will they ever survive? Who will take care of them? What kind of enjoyment or satisfaction can they possibly have? Only the religious traditions, peculiarly only those traditions which base themselves on our scripture, have insisted on the sacredness of human life, all human life, life defined as a single human being, not defined in terms of health, or in terms of capacity, or in terms of class, but simply in terms of consciousness, awareness, person. He who destroys a single life is as if he destroys the whole world. And he who saves a single life is as if he saves the whole world. Now that's very noble. But what are we to do with the inventions of modern science? What are we to do with the conditions which we see all about us? How can the doctor practice his medicine, knowing that much of what he does, if he must inevitably do everything that can be done in order to prolong, to protract, must be done? Well, there's another position in Jewish law. It's based on the biblical statement that a man who is to be executed may be given certain kinds of analgesics, of dope, in order that his sensation and his awareness may be dimmed and deadened, that he won't have to face the cruelty of the hour. There is the commandment, in other words, to mitigate pain. And this commandment is against the commandment to prolong life, to preserve life, are in inevitable tension. There will never be a simple, clear definition, solution to that tension. What are we to do? How are we to live? And what standards are we to adopt? Well, the first standard, it seems to me, is to accept the the new definition of death. It's a perfectly adequate one. To define death not by heart and not by breathing, but by the death of the brain or by an irreversible coma. These are things really that the medical profession can rather easily and clearly make out in most cases. And if we learn to accept death in those terms, the family will not be guilty when the doctor says to them, should I try everything that can be done? If they say no, the point of no return has been passed. And the doctor will know how to operate when he comes to the family and he says, there is no more life. The body may still be pumping, but life as we know it is gone. The old Jewish myth here is, or metaphor is perhaps a good one. Death was described as the departure of the soul. And to me, soul has always been defined as personality, control, individuality, capacity, awareness. When these have gone, life has flown. And until we begin to operate in areas of science or metaphysics, which we cannot even contemplate today, they'll never be recaptured for the body. And I think all of us had better learn to govern our relationships with others with a sense that we expect this kind of non-innocent contemporary definition of death as one to govern their decisions. A family does no act of kindness to an elderly parent when they look the doctor pleadingly in the eye and they say, please do everything you can do. For whom? For what? Often the answer is to assuage our guilt. What about the argument that we have no right to interfere in God's plans? It is God who gives life and God who takes life away. Well, the only person who can logically argue in this way is a Christian Scientist who refuses medication from birth to death. But the minute we go to a doctor, we ask someone to interfere in the measurement of our life. When a doctor allows a child to be born prematurely because he has the techniques to bring that child to health, he interferes, does he not? And how often have all of our lives been saved, been lengthened by the discoveries, the immunizations, the surgeries, which modern medicine has made possible? If we interfere on one side of the equation, certainly we must at times interfere on the other side of the equation. And that's why it seems to me that the second step that we must come to is one that the physician and the associations of physicians must come to. And that is, they must come to the position where medical heroics are not looked upon as inevitable, necessary procedures, but as procedures which must be justified. And the justification must rest somehow on whether or not life which has some meaning can be resorted to, can be reborn, rekindled in the person. It ought not to be an inevitable procedure. The great teams of doctors descend upon the patient during their last moments to try and pull the patient through and work hour after hour with all kinds of mechanical contrivances, even when it's very clear that nothing can be done. There must be some kind of judgment call, judgmental decision made by the doctor. And we must not expect the doctor, our doctor, to take these kinds of crisis decisions without some awareness of what he's fighting for. It's one thing to fight for a long time for the life of a 20-year-old whose life may be before him. When there's a least chance, one continues the struggle. And quite another thing to fight over the body of an 88-year-old whose full life is behind them, whose days are long, whose physical strength is minimal at best. These questions will not be easily decided by any physician. But I would hope that my physician, if I would ever get to such a place, would be one who would use his judgment as well as his skills. It's something I require of him. It's something that his own science today forces upon him. What am I saying? I'm saying that the miracles of modern medicine have made death for the first time a problem to us all. I know of many elderly who want nothing more than to be allowed to die. I don't think their suicide ought to be encouraged. But I do think that before we disturb their age with major surgery, or before we place their life systems under mechanical support, we, family, doctors, ought seriously to consider their wish and allow God to have his way. And I do think that all of us must become aware of the fact that death can no longer be described in terms of some purely instinctive pulsating systems within the body, but must somehow be described in terms of the mind. The brain is the human being. We die when the brain goes. That's when the soul leaves the body. To keep a vegetable alive is to keep a vegetable alive and nothing more. It's not to support the human being. I close with a story from our Talmud. It comes from an age when people believed in the real power of prayer, when they would pray all night beside the bed of one who was mortally ill, feeling that the angel of death could never cross the barrier of their prayers as long as they uttered the name of God in these invocations. A rabbi by the name of Rabbi Joshua lay dying, and all of his disciples had gathered in the room next door, which was both their synagogue and their school, and they prayed hour after hour after hour for his recovery. And he couldn't die. Finally, a pious maid in the house went into the schoolroom, and she stopped the disciples at their prayers, and she said, "For what are you praying?" "You're praying for his agony. He is with God. Let him be." And he died. And the Talmud praises her for this action. Amen.